Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00052. Recorded on June 29, 2023. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Revolutionary Scrapyard. Chapter 52.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
Post-Harlan Monologics is a monologue format audio podcast. It is what has become known in the common era as infotainment, which is to say the content is both informative and entertaining. The premise of Post-Harlan Monologics is a description of conditions in the 21st century AD from a DFW perspective by an aging building maintenance guy. That guy is me. I'm Maverick 88. I cover odd shit from my weird neighborhood and product reviews, Texas things, holy scripture, and the culture war. Fair warning, I am Texan by choice, but I was raised in New Jersey, so take cover. There will be F-bombs. For more information, please visit www.post-arlen.com. Okay, time to get it in gear.
In the neighborhood. News from the home front.
So, you might know by now, we got some characters in our neighborhood and in our town in general, but right in our neighborhood. It always just seems to be somebody. Right? Always seems to be somebody. We got this one guy. And I didn't realize he was a neighborhood guy, really. I caught him originally the first few times I seen him. Heading home on my commute, I'd be a couple of blocks away from home. And I see this guy very hastily, right? Little dude who's hastily pushing a wheelbarrow down his street, right? He's cranking. He's cruising. Little guy, like gorilla arms, must have the strongest trapezius muscles on earth because he's pushing this wheelbarrow around the entire city, as far as I know. I've seen him in different places at different times. But yeah, he's the wheelbarrow man, right? This is how I refer to him, the wheelbarrow man. A little guy, like I said, pushing a wheelbarrow around. And it turns out that, he's not no stranger. He's not somebody new. He's been around for years. My wife is familiar. It's really my wife's neighborhood where she grew up. And, Yeah, the guy lives around the corner with a bunch of other kind of questionable people, right? You know, a lot of the trouble in our neighborhood stems out of just one particular housing unit, right? And he's in there with them, you know, broken out windows, door left open. It's a decrepit kind of place, really. In a bad neighborhood, it's like the worst of it all. He comes out of there, and he's really weird, and he's got a really weird look on his face. He looks like really pissed off and really happy at the same fucking time, like being really pissed off about being happy or really being happy about being pissed off. But he's got this weird, and in the expression somewhere is like this dogged determination. And he's very energetic. He's got a hop in his step, and he's pushing this wheelbarrow around. Now, what he does with the wheelbarrow, apparently, is what a lot of people in my neighborhood do. He collects up metal and brings it over to the scrap yards. There's a bunch of scrap yards in our city, right? Our city is industrial / semi-industrial, and it's it's a support city of Dallas, which is of course a major city in the United States. So it's part of the Dallas infrastructure and the support of that, and it's just going to have these things that support industry, that support the big city, and scrap yards are a part of that, right? Now, you know, your town, wherever you live, you may have like a scrap yard for metal somewhere in there. But an industrial and semi-industrial place with factories and things like that, they're going to have multiple scrap yards, right? Because there's a larger need. There's commercial need for it. But in our city, we could put anything out on the fucking curb, and the city will come and collect it every week, right? You cut down a whole tree and just throw all the fucking logs out there. The city will come by and pick it up. Anything you throw out there on the day that they come, the special day they got put aside to pick up scrap type of items like that, if it's on the curb, they're going to take it, right? But before they even get there, there's all kinds of people that drive through the neighborhoods with little pickup trucks and in some cases wheelbarrows, right? To pick up whatever scrap they could find. They sift through your garbage and they take whatever metal they can find out of it. And this guy's one of them. He throws it in his wheelbarrow. He fills his wheelbarrow up and then he walks across town to one of the fucking scrap yards, empties it out, goes back and tries it again, right? But yeah, we have multiple people. In fact, somebody in the family even does this shit, right? They go around looking for scrap metal to take over to the scrap yard. And, you get paid by weight, depending on the different grade of metal that you bring in. You all probably know about some of this stuff, right? So, yeah, so we got the wheelbarrow man. Now, the problem with the wheelbarrow man is, he looks like he's crazy. And I think he is, by what my wife's got to say. And he's one of the people, like I had spoken previously about theft in the neighborhood, right? And a certain kind of mentality that seems to go along with the neighborhood, where if you ain't got it locked up or nailed down, it's free for the taking, right? It's community property. I spoke of a kid who just walked up and took a bicycle that didn't belong to him and just walked off broad daylight like it was his, no problem. Well, this guy will do the same thing. You know, you leave something, a piece of metal out in the yard, whatever it may be. It could be, like a hoe, like a garden hoe, right? And you got a wooden or fiberglass post into the actual metal tool at the end. He'll take the metal tool right off and put it in his wheelbarrow and walk away, right behind your back. You know, you put down the hoe to go in and get a drink of water or something, you come back. Here's this guy fucking sawing off your garden tool. It's like that. It's like I said, you got to mind your shit in this neighborhood. Right? It's fucked up, you know. But this guy is, I don't know what his issues are, and I have sympathy and pity for people that are in that position. I am not of extraordinary means myself. You know, I'm working poor, and I'm not afraid to say it. I mean, it's true. Why would I say otherwise? But there's poor that isn't working, right? And when you're poor and you're not working, you have to do what you got to do. And that's part of what you got to do. And I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with people coming and sifting through the garbage that we put out on the street, except when they just leave it all over the place, right? You know, as long as they work neatly and keep everything contained, garbage, you know, is your treasure. Our garbage is your treasure. But if it's not garbage and you come up and take it, well, that's fucking theft and I got a problem. I had a problem with that. And I look at this guy with cross-eyed now, knowing that this is how he is. He's going to steal whatever he sees. It doesn't have to be out on the curb. It's just out anywhere. If he sees it, it's his, and he'll take it. That's fucked up. And I wouldn't even know how to begin to engage with this person in a conversation if it ever came down to it. I don't know that he speaks English. He looks fucking crazy. He obviously has a degree of desperation to him. And that is not uncommon in the city that I live in, right? Those components, those factors that describe a person, it seems kind of commonplace. You know, the closer you are to downtown especially, and we're close to downtown, there's just that element there. There's a lot of people with a lot of problems. There's a lot of people with a lot of circumstances, you know. But we got them, and you got to keep an eye on them. The wheelbarrow man. The wheelbarrow man.
Objectification. Maverick 88. Product and service reviews.
There are some things in this world that truck drivers might be aware of that the rest of us might not be aware of, right? And it's the fact that our tires, right? We have the dual setup tires, right? The dually tires. Your tires are stacked up one next to each other, side by side, on one side of the axle, right? Both of them have the structure to hold up whatever is riding on top of it. You know, either the rear of the vehicle or the trailer of the vehicle, right? It will have tires side by side. Now, picture what I'm saying, right? You got one tire on the left, one tire on the right. They're right next to each other, almost touching. They both structurally support the weight of whatever they're attached to, whether it's a trailer or the rear of a tractor. But if one of the tires happens to be flat, the structure of the one next to it that isn't flat will hold everything in place, and you wouldn't be able to tell the flat tire is flat by looking at it. Capiche? Makes sense? It'll hold its form. There won't be a flat spot on the ground for you to see because the other tire is keeping everything propped up off the ground. So, the quick way to determine whether or not one of your dually tires is flat is to walk by it and give it a good whack with something, right? A tire that has it's a full complement of air pressure will make a certain sound, give off a certain pitch, and a flat tire will give off a certain thud. And you might even feel it give a little bit if it's flat enough, right? So you could tell where your tires are at just by whacking them, right? So what do you whack them with? Well, anything, but there is actually a device that is made for the express purpose of a truck driver checking his tires like this, and it's called a tire thumper, right? A tire thumper. You can find tire thumpers in your truck stops generally, some larger, more full-service fueling stations in general, but definitely at a truck stop. It is trucker equipment. And, of course, these things can be ordered online, too. Now, I own a tire thumper, right? I own a tire thumper. and I don't have dualies. I seek to thump other things, potentially. A tire thumper to me is a weapon. A tire thumper to me back then when I drove a truck was a weapon. See, a fucked up thing about the transportation industry is, as a company driver, you're not allowed to carry a firearm in your vehicle. In fact, the rule may be now that if you are an interstate driver, you cross state lines on your routes, even if you're an owner-operator, you may not be able to possess a firearm. Now, I'm not sure. I was never owner-operator, and of course, the rules have changed in the past 15-plus years, right? Or, yeah, about 15 years since I drove. And so you got a lot of people out there working the stressful, shitty job. You know, the trucker's life is not an easy life. And it's not a glamorous life. And anytime those wheels aren't moving, you're in danger. You're in danger. There's underlying stress in the job, right? You think of a truck driver, you think, hey, he's just driving down the road, driving in the sunset, everything is groovy. Every once in a while, he's got to back up and, you know, they empty out his trailer and he goes pick up a full trailer and drives along again. Nothing to it. Well, the truth of the matter is there's all kinds of stress with the job. The obvious stress of the job is making your deadlines, right? You have a load that you're picking up at a certain time. You got to be there on time to get it. And you have to deliver it at the time allotted. And you are judged and regarded on your ability to come through on time. And if you fail to meet deadlines, you fail to keep your job, right? So there's that stress. And every job has got that kind of stress to it. So that's nothing extraordinary. But with a trucker, there's a lot more stress, and it's very kind of under the radar in comparison. You're not meeting deadlines per se, but operating the truck, for example, there's so much that you got to be mindful of, and you could never slack in your attentiveness while you're driving, because people do stupid shit on the road, right? You could be driving around in a car, pickup truck, you know, something non-professional and not that large. And you see, as you sit in traffic and you share the road with all of our other quote-unquote American brothers and sisters, we see the ridiculousness, the inattentiveness, the selfishness, the carelessness. People are egocentric. People are focused completely on themselves and their little bubble. And they are so ridiculously oblivious to the surroundings around them. And so many of the problems that are caused, that we call, you know, on the roadways, that we call, quote unquote, accidents, or no accident at all. It's always going to be some matter of inattentiveness, whether somebody's not paying attention at all, or somebody's attention is impaired by alcohol, drugs, whatever, you know. Most everything is a matter of attentiveness when it comes to driving. So what I'm saying is, even as you're zipping around in your small, non-professional vehicle, you're plainly aware of the inattentiveness of people and the stupid things they do as a result. And you realize that there always seems to be a little buffer in time, in your reaction time, to the stupidity of others. Even your own stupidity, right? You could fuck up a little bit, and there's always time to catch yourself and adjust. But when you're driving 18-wheeler, you don't have that time. Those things are so fucking heavy, and they're so boxy, and they're so long and bulky. You don't just slam on your brakes and come to a stop. You don't just swerve from one lane into another. All kinds of shit happens. A trucker cannot wait to the very last microsecond to react to anything that's happening. A trucker's always got to be 10 seconds ahead of every possibility to avoid trouble. Now, truckers who are inattentive, they're going to find themselves, you know, they're going to find their trailer coming up around the front of them, you know, to say hello. They're going to find themselves flying off the road. They're going to find themselves barreling into the back end of somebody who come to a stop in front of them, you know. Shit's going to happen. But that's inattentiveness, right? Everybody who drives needs to have some measure, a good measure, a high measure of quality attentiveness. But for a trucker, it's even more so. And because of that, if you care even for your own skin enough, you'll be highly attentive to everything that's going on. And that attention, and you'll drive 10 hours straight. You've got to maintain that attention. That brings with it its own level of stress, right? And then something I think even deeper down, right? Just a layer deeper in terms of stress, in terms of stress and our awareness to our own stress factors, is this loneliness and isolation, this set apartness out on the road, where if you, for example, break down, you have mechanical failure, you got to pull off into the shoulder on some freeway out in the middle of nowhere. Now it's just you in a broke down tractor trailer waiting for somebody to come to your aid, and anybody can just pull up and start with you. And if they're armed and you're not, you're fucked. You're defenseless against somebody who's armed. It's just another example in this country of stupid fucking gun laws that don't make sense. You know, I know it's been changed, right? It's not fair to me to bring it up, but I remember when I lived in Tennessee's a pretty good gun state. In fact, right now it's probably one of the better ones in this country, but when I lived there, it had a couple of odd rules that made you scratch your head, right? Like, you could conceal carry, and I had a concealed carry license that just expired recently. I just let it go. It's all right. We've got reciprocal laws with Tennessee and Texas. It doesn't really matter. And I can get it again, you know, as an out-of-state. But whatever. That's all way beside the point. All this is way beside the point. But as a licensed citizen, licensed to conceal carry in the state of Tennessee, where I lived, Tennessee had its own little laws regarding proper concealed carry. And one of them was that you couldn't carry in a bank, right? You have a gun, you're allowed to carry it around for self-defense, but when you go into a bank, no, you can't bring it into the bank. And I'm thinking to myself, what fucking knucklehead thought this up? A bank is the place where you need a gun. A bank is a place where people come in with guns to steal money, and you're just an average Joe standing in line waiting to do your business with the bank. And now you're defenseless in a place where you know shit's going to happen? Didn't make sense to me at all. They've since changed that, right? But man, I thought that was so stupid, and that really just it brought my ire up. And then when I understand, you know, a trucker's life, because I lived it, right? A trucker's life is defenseless as it is. It's the same thing. I think those people should absolutely. I think that truck, even though it's a business, it's commerce, it's interstate commerce, even though you might be a company driver, you're in that truck, you're sleeping in that thing overnight. That is just like your car. That is your domicile. And most states that have, well, they call the castle law, right? An extension of the castle law is the fact that as it goes in your house, as far as defending yourself and your house and your property, it also goes for your car, right? And your motorcycle and your boat, all that shit, right? It should be that way. But where the feds get involved with it, it gets all fucked up. It's incredible. Bring the fucking leftist stupidity into everything, right? So anyway, all that said, and that may be just a learning lesson for you, maybe a little bit of dusting off some of the aggravation in my life with some of the just stupid, not very thought out rules in this world where you're subjecting people to be defenseless and killed as a result of it, right? Now, I've got more. I've got a long list of these things, and they all piss me off too, right? I can go on and on. I'm not going to. And I'm thinking, all right, I'm a trucker. I drive up to a truck stop, right, because you got to refuel those tanks up every once in a while. Back into a spot somewhere, and I'm going to get out, and I'm going to go hit the restroom and maybe shower up, because the truck stops, they have showers for the truckers in there you can hit up, and maybe get me some coffee and something else to eat for the next stretch. You know, I used to smoke. Maybe I'd buy a carton of cigarettes if I was down south somewhere where it was cheap to get cigarettes. But between my truck and the retail establishment at the truck stop, I would have to walk. And it could be 100 yards, 200 yards. It could be dead in the middle of the night. And there's a lot of bad element that hangs out at truck stops. I don't know if you've ever heard of lot lizards, but you have prostitutes that hang out there. And with the prostitutes, might be their pimps. There could be squabbles. You could get caught in fucking gunfire. All kinds of shit can happen, right? But when you've got that kind of element, you've also got the desperation that comes with that kind of element. Problems can come up really fucking quick. And guess what? I am basically, as far as firearms are concerned, defenseless. And you know what? Anybody who knows the industry knows that. They're there. If they want to just steal shit from you, if they want to bust your window while you're laying there asleep and poke a gun in it and say you're fucking dead if you breathe, then they just start ripping your radios out or whatever they can get their hands on right quick. There's really nothing to stop them. Really nothing to stop them from doing that shit. It's just an unprotected element, and it's like you feel that. And what I'm talking about is the underlying stress of not being able to defend yourself to the fullest. Now, you can do things that are, you know, you defend yourself in lesser means that don't involve firearms, and one of those is the tire thumper. Right? The tire thumper. You could carry the tire thumper in with you where you go. Okay, well, you buy your tire thumper, the one I have, and let me talk about the tire thumper, right? It's basically a small baseball bat. Basically a small baseball bat. So that would be one of my weapons, right? And the small baseball bat I got is from a company called Road Pro, one word. They're a company out of Elizabethtown, Pennsylvania, but their line of tire thumpers are actually, you guessed it, made in China, right? Which is sad. Well, I don't know. Mine might not be made in China. I bought mine a long time ago, and I still have it here. Tire thumper was one of the weapons that I would carry with me, and the other weapon would be a hammer, right? A hammer. If you ever did construction work, you get this little hammer hook that you could put on your belt, and then you could just slide a hammer through it, and you just look like a normal guy working. You know, I work, I carry a hammer around. You walk into the truck stop. If anybody tries to violence you, assault you on the way, coming and going, if they ain't got a firearm, you got a fair shot. I would not want to get whacked by a hammer by me. I could swing a fucking hammer, and that would be deadly, right? Walking around with a tire thumper is not as good as a hammer for two reasons. A, you pretty much got to hold it in your hand, right? The one I have, I was describing, tire thumper, Road Pro tire thumper. It'll come with a leather strap that you could carry in your hand, but that's how you're going to carry it. You're going to carry it in your hand. So you're walking around the store with a tire thumper in your hand. That's problem number one. People already think that you're looking for trouble. Problem number two is they sell them in the store. So you bring your tire thumper into the store, they're going to think it's their tire thumper. and you're stealing it when you don't pay for it, right? So you're just asking for problems. Better to go in with a hammer is what I'm saying. I have a tire thumper and I never bring it anywhere. It stays in my truck, and it is just one line of many for defending myself while I'm out and about. Now, of course, I'm generally locked and loaded to begin with, but if I don't have to point a gun at somebody, I'm not going to point a gun at somebody, right? If I could thump them instead, if I can kneecap them, I'll do that, right? So let me tell you about the tire thumper anyway, right? It's kind of dancing around that. I just want to get that in. This is a product review ultimately, and this tire thumper ain't got a whole hell of a lot of use because it's a defense weapon, and I've not had to fucking kneecap anybody yet or clobber them upside the head yet with it. But so it's pretty much new. But I've had them in the past, the same brand, the same kind, everything like that, when I was actually driving the truck and I would use them. You know, whenever I'd get out the truck, I'd grab the tire thumper and I'd go around and I would check all my tires, right? And I might even do it twice. You know, I might get out, check them. I might check them before I roll off again, because you just can't trust anybody when you're parked and walk away from the truck. People will fuck with you. That brings stress into your life. I don't know if I finished that, but that underlying sense of just the vulnerability adds stress. It's a stressful job, right, driving a truck. It just really is. So anyway, the tire thumper. It's a Road Pro RPTT-1 wooden tire thumper, 19 inches in length, and there's two varieties of them. I've always had the one. There's one. One is natural wood color, which is probably the better looking of the two. Like a classic baseball bat, right? And the other one is kind of this, it's a brown, it's like a rusty brown color. Like, it's definitely the color of rust. Not quite orange, not quite brown, somewhere in between. And that's the color of both of the ones that I've had in my life, including the one that's sitting right here right now on my lap as I speak. So you got two to choose from, right? So assorted dark or light wood. These come with a leather strap to wrap your hand through so it doesn't go flying away from you. The handle is notched out all the way around the diameter. It's not a baseball bat design, but it's similar to a baseball bat. It's I don't even know how to describe the shape. I mean, the handle part of it is this one-handed grip. Your hand fits in. You'd have to go look it up. Look it up to see. I cannot describe it any further. 19 inches in length is very short of a baseball bat, which makes it better than a baseball bat as a weapon is concerned. Let's go back to weapons now for a moment. I was a baseball player. I grew up playing baseball, and we would have brawls, right? People would break out in a fight. Invariably, somebody's got a bat in their hand. They're coming at you with a bat. You ain't got one. What do? You don't run. Why? Because they run after you, and they got that extra length. They'll catch you. They swing at that fucking thing. Unless you're really fast, like I would. It was, and you can outrun them. Jump over a fence and shit like that. Then they come to chase after you over the fence, and you can wallop them right there. But mano a mano, somebody's coming at you with a baseball bat. They need distance to be able to hit you with the sweet part of the bat. So all you got to do is get inside their hands. As they approach you, you just quickly get inside where they can't hit you with the bat. And you grab at the bat itself, you grab at their arm or something like that, and it's over. They're stuck holding on to this fucking thing, and they're completely vulnerable. And then you just start kicking them and kneeing them and whatever, you know, headbutts. As long as they're going to hold on to that bat, they got no free hands, right? A short bat's a better deal. Something that you could wield one-handed, that you could hit somebody who gets close in on you. And if you need to let it go, you just let it go, right? It's not a two-handed thing. Better deal all the way around. It's better for a weapon. But anyway, back to this Road Pro RPTT-1 wooden tire thumper. 19 inches in length, right? This 19-inch wooden tire thumper lets you know if your tires are fully pressurized by making a thump as it hits the rubber. Just swing a thumper and listen for the sound. If your tires are low in pressure, it makes a different sound. Save time checking tire pressure on your rig with this wooden tire thumper. Of note, it's durable solid wood. It won't tell me what kind of wood. I wish it would. Rigid handle and leather strap. That's about all they're going to say about it. You order it from Amazon, you don't get a choice of what color you get. You order it and they give you what color they have, which is fucked up. I would definitely want the one color over the other. Sure. Doesn't say what kind of wood it is, what kind of blows. I don't think it's pine. It would dent very easy. I doubt it's pine. Some kind of hardwood. Well, it said hardwood, but it won't tell you what kind. It probably varies depending on what they get their hands on. But anyway, there it is. It's the Ropro. Now, I could tell you that, you know, when I drove, I used one of these things to thump tires, and I don't know that there would be an end of life. I think the thing would just basically last forever as far as thumping tires are concerned. I think it makes a good weapon for close proximity, good for kneecapping somebody, good for hitting somebody, smacking somebody upside the side of the head, maybe cracking an elbow or something if they get in your space, just enough to kind of take control of the situation, right? Not a bad idea to come out lefty if you're a righty with a tire thumper and righty with your pistol. But you decide how you're going to fight. This is a practical tool for a particular situation. Now, of course, I'm talking about truck drivers, but if you happen to be driving like a 2500 or 3500 size pickup truck and you got dualies on the back for hauling stuff, you know, bigger, heavier trailers, you could also, obviously, any kind of dually situation on a vehicle, you could check your tires with a tire thumper, right? So that's it. The Ropro RPTT-Wood Wooden Tire Thumper.
Waltz across Texas. Any and all things Lone Star State.
Well, my wife and I managed to get out again. That's two weekends in a row. All right, it's summertime. It's happy time. I love the summer. I don't care how hot it is. It's, you know, it's getting hot now. It's at triple digits, 99, 100 every day this week. Over the weekend, hot as fuck. Humid and everything. I don't want to give you a weather report. It's summertime in Texas. And, you know, I don't mind. This is the time of the year that I like the best for whatever reason. The threat of storms go away. The hail storms, the tornadoes, right? Skies kind of dry up. The storm fronts stop coming through. The cold fronts don't get here. You don't get generally a whole lot of humidity blowing up off the Gulf. It's mostly desert air at this point. You know, when you get into late June, July, August, actual summer months, right? Calendar summer. And, I don't know. It seems to wear everybody else out, but it sparks me up. I like to be able to go places without having to think about fucking hailstones coming down on me, you know? That's just me. Maybe a couple other people. I got a phobia about the fucking hail. But anyway, we got out, right? We got out and about over the weekend. Like I said, two weekends in a row. And one was the rodeo, which I spoke about last time. This time we went to a tractor pull, right? A truck and tractor pull, a real redneck event. You probably know that already. Something I never did. It was always on my bucket list to do, right? It's just something I always wanted to do. My wife had done it before multiple times, so she was familiar, which is good. At least one of us can explain something to the other person, right? The week before we went to the rodeo, I'd been, she'd not been, so I can explain a thing or two about that. Not that I'm a master of it by any regards, but I wish I was, right? Anyway, up in Grayson County, right, which is two counties north of Dallas County, not far from Collin County, is a town, little country town called White Right. WHITEWRIGHT. It's got both. Never mind. White Right, Texas hosts an annual truck and tractor pull at the White Right Truck and Tractor Pull Grounds, which we are familiar with. We've gone to a couple of biker events at the place, right? You can rent out the place there. They got a pavilion covered up and big smokers and grills and shit, and even a little gun range off to the side. So it's a great place for bikers to go. You could rent it out and go up there, a couple hundred people, 1,000 people if you could do it, you know. Go up there and do biker shit, biker games and all this kind of stuff. And we've gone to a couple events up there with some of the clubs that we're friendly with and people that we know. So we're familiar with the place, but I'd never actually gone to the tractor pole event until this past weekend. We finally made it up there. So the White Right Truck and Tractor Pull. Apparently it's a big deal in the truck and tractor pull world, right? Bleacher seating, both sides, two strips. Basically like two drag strips, but they're earthen, right? Dirt. And the dirt is constantly worked. Every time somebody does a pull, they come out with the equipment and smooth everything out, flatten it all out, ready it up for the next guy. So you have these two tracks side by side, and they've got these big, and I lack the words, I can't even really describe very well. They're basically trailers that are very heavy in weight, and as they proceed forward down the track, there's a shift in weight which causes the front end to go lower and lower and lower until it's even scraping the ground like a plow. And in front of it, you have either a souped-up pickup truck or a souped-up tractor, you know, farm tractor, pulling this thing as far as it'll go. And they're judged on how far they get it to go, right? So it's a fascination of mechanical competition. People with money turn this into their big hobby, and they put teams together, mechanics and shit like that. It's similar to auto racing. It's just not racing. You're pulling weight, you know. But it's in the lines of, like, drag strip racing. As far as hobbies go, people from all over, they have these ginormous trailers that they put their tractors and fancy trucks in and cart them around the country to events like this. White Right's one of the big ones, apparently. But they will also do large events in a... White Right's maybe not big in size, but big in history. It goes back to like the 70s, right? So it's like one of the real old venues for the event. I was catching a little bit of history of it as I went. But they will, time to time, in big cities in the South, they'll rent out, like, stadiums and set up a tractor pull inside there. Like I said, big redneck event. Thousands of rednecks come out to see this stuff, and they do redneck things. And, no, I don't like that. I have to describe it as something very particular in culture, like, you know, a redneck event, as opposed to just an American event. It's just something that redneck culture does. I would definitely invite all people from all cultures to go and check it out and hang around. I had a good time. I like getting out in the country. I like redneck events. There's something earthy and hearty, good-spirited about it. And people are there drinking beers, you know. And there's no telling how many people are walking around with a pistol because it's concealed. I'm open carrying around. I think I saw two cops, like two sheriff deputies there. And there's, I don't know how many people, somewhere between 3,000 and 10,000, I would guess. I don't really know. You don't need cops because there ain't going to be trouble. and there's no trouble. When people are there, some are carrying pistols, some ain't, who knows, it's concealed, most cases. Some people are drinking beer, everybody's eating garbage food. And you know what it's like? Let me tell you what it's like. You're watching an event, you're up there in the bleachers, doing like everybody else. And everybody, like, you could bring your... Here's an interesting thing, right? Nobody's waving a wand at you when you enter in to check you for metal detection or anything like that, right? And no violence breaks out, nothing happens. You carry any fucking weapon you want into there, you know? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's a family event. There's kids of all ages, there's old-timers, and everything in between. You're sitting up there, and here's what I'm trying to say. Not only do you not get wanded for metal detection on the way in, you bring your own coolers, right? You are not Nazi fucking pigeonholed into buying their water, you know, for $8 a fucking bottle, like most events are. Bring your own. You bring your own cooler and bring your own bags in. Bring everything that you want to bring in, right? And we did. Now we brought a cooler of water. Didn't bring any food up. I figure we would just buy what they had out there just for one night, you know, eat like garbage redneck fried food shit, you know, try something maybe you never had before, maybe. So we're up there, and everybody becomes neighbors in the crowd. Usually I can't stand being in a crowd. My wife is even worse, you know. I just don't like people around. I don't like people too close, too loud, too human, you know, whatever. Most people share that same sentiment about people in general. Don't want to be in a crowd. You hate having people all around you. You hate feeling cramped in and closed in, all that shit. And, you know, with the weather being very hot and very humid, you couldn't be more ornery, right? You're all bloated and sweaty. You're eating all the salty food. You know, I felt kind of physically miserable. But the nature of the people around us, they were country people. And they become neighbors in the stands. It's like, all right, right now, you know, you and your wife are here. That's your little house in the stand. And now this guy and his wife and his kids are over there. That's their little house on a stand in your neighborhood, right? And everybody's like sharing food. Hey, I got some of these. You want some? Yeah, okay, we'll give you this. We're passing food around. You know, hey, you want a water? That's it. It's the best display of humanity I can imagine. It's all I'd want to see from people, is to be able to go to a place, be entertained by people who really try hard and invest a lot of money into their competition, enjoy that, and enjoy it in the company of people that are just simply, for no good fucking reason, neighborly. What a blessing. What a great thing. They only run it once a year. That's the sad thing about it. But it restored my faith in humanity, right? I recommend it highly to anybody, you know, not just a white right one, but I guess it's going to be that way anywhere you're going to find a tractor pole. Why? Because the tractor poles like this are going to be done out in the country somewhere. You're going to be surrounded with country people. The country don't know colors. Country is just country. It is rural versus urban. Urban mentality, rural mentality, two different things. All the problems come with the urban mentality. And for every reason in the world. We all need a dose of country in our life just to give us balance, restore our faith in humanity, clear us of all the agitation that compiles with our hour-to-hour, day-to-day experience in urban America and even suburban America, right? One day, God willing, and the creek don't rise, my wife and I will get to live in rural America, where we belong, where it will no longer be an aspiration, but it'll actually be an actuality. But until then, people like us need to escape, get out, get some fresh air. We have events like tractor pulls and rodeos to draw us out to the country. And it's a good time, a safe place to bring your kids. You don't have to get all dressed up. Costs nothing. It was $10 a person, right? And less for kids. Parking free. Bring your own food. Bring your own drinks. Bring your knives. Bring your guns. No problems. The one place you don't need even need that stuff, but you can have it there, right? Good time. I expect I go back next year again, and I'll be looking for other tractor pulls to go to. Go on YouTube and look at tractor pulls and truck pulls. Get a visual of what I'm talking about. It's really just a good time. You know, I think that the people watching and being in and amongst the people made the event for me. But the enormity of the mechanics, the engines, the multiple engines on these vehicles, the power that they exhibited, that is very much sensational. I wish I was more mechanically oriented and I can have a hobby that's somewhere on the lines of all that stuff. If I could find a mechanic class to go to, I just might go and do that just for the hell of it. But it's got to fit in with my schedule, of course, right? I haven't given up on that possibility. Anyway, yeah, so White Wright, Texas, truck and tractor pull.
It's going to be biblical. A weekly dose of Christian perspective.
This week's Bible section is a random verse. Literally pulled up a random verse on a random verse generator website that I found randomly in a random web search. Okay? Press a button, gives you a Bible quote. This is the one that I got. This is what I'm running with. It's from Paul's letter to the Galatians, right? Chapter 2, verse 16, reads as follows. Knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law, but by the faith of Jesus Christ, even we have believed in Jesus Christ, that we might be justified by the faith of Christ and not by the works of the law. For by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified. All right, so that's a mouthful, a head full. It's one of Paul's kind of run-on style sentences, a little bit hard to parse, especially in the King James version, but the King James translation as I read it to you. But that doesn't make it impossible. And if it's difficult for you to understand Paul's style of writing, pray to God for the ability to understand it, and God will give it to you, right? That's how it worked for me many, many years ago. Knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law, see, but by the faith of Jesus Christ. Just that portion, right? That portion, that beginning portion of verse 16. We're really weighing two things in the balance here. One of them is what Paul's referring to as the works of the law. And the other thing is the faith in Jesus Christ. Right? These are two aspects on a scale of justice. Okay, I hope you're getting this visualization. right? One side of the scale works a law. The other side of the scale is this faith, this matter of faith, faith in Jesus Christ. In summary, the verse is saying that no, you are not going to be justified, right? There's a key word, justified by works of the law, but instead you will be justified by your faith in Christ. That's the picture, okay? That's the visual picture of the textual verse as I read it to you. This is what's going on here. Now, let's define some of these things along the way. Let's define some of these things along the way. Justification is God's judgment, God's moral judgment on a human being, right? In review of a human being's existence, God casts a judgment, and that is justification, or lack thereof. God can approve a man or disprove a man as being regarded as just. And what does that mean? Being recognized as right, righteous, correct, abiding within God's moral constraints, definitions. When we're talking about justification here, we're talking about God's judgment on our soul. And we do not achieve the affirmative judgment of God on our soul, according to Apostle Paul, by what he calls works of the law, but rather by our faith in Christ. Okay? Now, works of the law, we can complicate the hell out of that very quickly and easily, right? Law, in the biblical sense, can mean a couple of different things. We've already regarded to God's morality, right? So you have moral law, which is basically defined by the Ten Commandments that God gave to Moses, right? That's your moral law. But the Israelites, also through Moses, were given a civil law, or civic law, which was what? It was the means by which the nation should operate. It was a code for judges to assess problems in the community, to resolve disputes, to keep the culture pure, right? So you have that civil law along with a moral law. And then there's even a third element as Paul, through his epistles, is speaking to the law. Paul, in his own biography, had been what's known as a Pharisee. And the Pharisees had their own kind of law. As part of the Sanhedrin, the ruling body, the governing body of the Jews in Jerusalem at the time of Christ walking on earth, right? Paul was one of that element, the Pharisees. They had their own law, which Peter had described as an overbearance that nobody can abide to live up to, a weight that nobody could carry. So when we're hearing Paul, Apostle Paul, Saint Paul, speak of quote unquote the law, it can be any of these three things depending on the specific context within, right? Now, the full context of this verse is a little bit of a dispute that Apostle Paul was having with Apostle Peter, where it involved the lifestyle of the Jews and the lifestyle of the Gentiles. Paul was the apostle to the Gentiles. He was a Jew himself and a Pharisee who had quote-unquote, seen the light, right? Jesus met him on the road to Damascus and showed him what's true and led him away from this false life he had been leading as a Pharisee, right? False beliefs, false everything, right? And Paul was led as a lone Jew out into the wide world to preach Jesus Christ. And in that, he became known as the apostle to the Gentiles, where the other apostles, the actual apostles that walked with Christ to his crucifixion, right? The quote-unquote 12, as they're known, they hung around in Jerusalem because Jesus had asked of them to deliver his message of salvation first to the Jew, then to the Gentile. And eventually, once the Jews had had time in and around Jerusalem to receive that message from the apostles there, the 12, they would be, as a result of the persecutions of Herod Agrippa first, forced out of Jerusalem and into the world, right? St. John, my patron saint, for example, left Jerusalem and ended up in Ephesus. And then he would be soon thereafter banished to the island of Patmos, where he would write the Apocalypse, right? Book of Revelation. That's one example of how the remaining 12 apostles were kind of forced out and follow into Paul's footsteps, out into the world, right? Of course, Peter ended up in Rome and died out that away, right? So anyway, all that to say, there were a little dispute now between Paul's perspective on the imposition of Jewish customs and lifestyle onto these Gentile populations. Now, Gentile is anything that's not a Jew, okay? There's Jews and then there's not Jews. And that's a biblical perspective, as it was at that time in the world 2,000 years ago, right? A very Jew-centric perspective on things. It is what it is, right? Was what it was. So Paul did not have very much of a regard for Peter's idea of imposing, and not just Peter's idea, but I think it was collectively the rest of the apostles, imposing along with the fact and faith of Christ to the Gentile population to replace all their pagan idolatries and all that shit. Also to bring in the culture and lifestyle of the Jews and the civic law, which includes like dietary things, right? What you can eat, what you cannot eat, what's clean, what's unclean. You're bringing that stuff to a population that has already been eating all this stuff for generations and generations. And now the point is not about the whole legalism of it all, per se. The point is that the civic law, the civil law that God imposed on Israel, ancient Israel as a nation, was about the nation of Israel. It was about how they would be, how they would conduct themselves. The initial blueprints for ancient Israel was that they would be a kingdom of priests unto the world. They would be the nation of God that would deliver God to the world. But it didn't work out that way. I mean, it sort of kind of did. Ultimately, Jesus Christ came, right, in the flesh, God in the flesh, to the world through Israel, and then through Jewish people, through Israel, set apostles out as ambassadors of himself, of God, the one true God, to the world. So it did work out that way in a sense, but the original design was that ancient Israel would be a kingdom ruled by God as king that would simply rule the earth as a result of the truth and fact of God, the creator of all things. But they kept on turning their faith away. They kept turning their eyes and their hearts away in preference of the gods of the surrounding nations, right? Ancient Israel had a recurring history, round and round, about turning their backs on their given one true God, the God of Abraham, right? In preference to sneaking out into the hills and joining in with the pagan rites and ritual at altars of gods that represented their neighboring nations. This is spiritual adultery. This is what God despised about the Israelites. Recurring over and over again throughout their history, right? It's a pattern that kept on happening. So ancient Israel never really lived up to the hopes and dreams that God had for it. So God made from it something that worked in a similar fashion. But in the working of that, the nation Israel was dissolved. So with the dissolution of Israel also comes the dissolution of their civil practices, their way of life no longer had a place on this earth. So then there was no reason to impose that shit upon the rest of humanity, because the rest of humanity was not going to be commissioned to be the nation of priests of the one true God. Do you follow that? Do you see that? I mean, it's a big point to make, but it's the whole true explanation of really what's going on contextually in this particular chapter of Galatians. Paul's having an argument about the place in humanity to come, especially in Christian humanity to come, but of course all humanity, because the rest of humanity, Gentile humanity, was by definition not Jewish. Why should Jewish things be imposed upon a people that weren't commissioned to be Israelites as a nation? Israelites in spirit, Israelites as a spiritual kingdom, but not as an actual geopolitical nation any further. So we are in the context of a dispute that Paul is having with Peter over this subject. Paul wins the dispute. So what will happen going forward is that none of this Jewish stuff will be hoisted upon the backs of Gentile Christians. But this verse itself now is speaking directly to the idea of works of the law versus the faith in Christ, right? Faith versus works. Now, the works of the law should first and foremost be looked at from the moral law perspective. Your commandments. Is this a person that keeps the commandments? And the answer is, the best answer for anybody is, they try damn hard to keep the commandments. But nobody really can, right? Nobody really can. We all fail. Before we know we failed, we've already failed. It's just so. The sin of this world and our susceptibility to it is so insidious that sin happens before we know it even happened. We don't have that kind of control over the situation. We are born into this morass and we require salvation. We cannot save ourselves, and this is the idea that Paul is bringing forward. We do not have, within the limitations of our human capacity, the ability to present ourselves justified before God on God's terms. God creates through Jesus Christ a set of terms that makes justification in humanity a possibility. And that is faith in Christ, right? faith in Christ. Now, some people will take this and go off the deep end, right? A lot of the different like sects within Protestant Christianity, you know, they go with the idea of faith alone, for example, right? You hear me talk about Scripture alone, sola scriptura. Well, you also have faith alone. And the idea is that anything that you do that is religious is a work of the law. And it obtains and has value of nothing. It is a waste, a vain expression, right? Where all you need to have is faith in Christ. And this is where Protestant Christianity kind of goes off into this black and white existence. It ends up being all about the black text on white paper in the Bible. And there just seems to be no color remaining for that which is religious and ritual, that which is mysterious and mystical. It all goes away into this very black and white, Vulcan-like faith. In the letter of James, right, comes later on in the New Testament, James, the brother of Jesus Christ, is an expression known well through the world. My first encounter with it was actually through literature in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? 12-step program for recovering alcoholics, which I mentioned from time to time. It had been a big part of my life. Recovery from alcoholism and addiction is central to my being, right alongside of my faith. Not as big as my faith, but the faith does not exist without the recovery. And here's what I'm getting to, right? The expression is this: faith without works is dead. Now, we're looking at a verse here, 2 Galatians, verse 16. It's talking about works and faith. And it's saying that faith is the weightier matter. That is what we are justified, right? That's what we are justified by. God gives us the terms of faith in Christ, and our faith in Christ is a means by which God justifies our souls. We are proven out. We are righteous in His eyes as a result of the faith in Christ. That's what Christianity is. 101. Christianity 101 is you get your ass to heaven because you believe in Jesus Christ. That's the simplest way to put it. All right? Now, on the other side of it is you've got these works of this law thing. And what Paul is saying is that without faith in Jesus Christ, we're not going to be justified. Whatever we do, all right, whatever we do, that's good. However many old ladies we help across the street, however much money we donate to charities, right? So you get what I'm getting. However charitable we are, any quote-unquote good thing that we can possibly do, these do not tally up and add up to a score which, if high enough, we enter in to heaven. Because all these things are negated by the actuality of sin in us and amongst us. That's what sullies us. We need to be cleansed of that completely. And there's nothing that we can do on our own volition outside of coming to faith in Christ, right? We hear the word and we move to the word. We hear of Jesus Christ and we accept Jesus Christ. That's the only thing that we can do. But once we do that, we have to hold to that. And here is where this idea of faith without works is dead comes into play, right? The idea that faith can be dead tells us that faith is a living thing, like an organism. The idea of faith without works is dead means that faith with works is what? Alive. So to keep our faith as an organism, right, as a living organism, alive and well, we need to do the works of the law. Capisce? Else, our faith withers and dies. So technically, we just need the faith to be justified. But without the works, our faith withers and dies anyway. And then we are dead anyway. See how that goes together? So the idea of faith alone is an extreme reaction to a particular verse or two or concepts, right? That are taken without their full context and their total completedness, and then run off into being theological concepts that mislead people grossly. And sadly, Protestantism, and I come out of there, and I have a lot of friends who are Protestant, and that doesn't mean that you are going to hell. It doesn't, you know, I don't look at it like that at all. These are actual faithful Christian people that have different outlook and approach. But if all we need is the faith, then that's all we need. And it turns out with these Protestants, they're doing a lot of the works of the law, even if they're preaching against it. Nobody is going to be more inclined as a laity population to go out and knock on doors to deliver Christ to the neighborhood than a Protestant. Nobody is going to take it up on his own and just start preaching in a fucking park somewhere more than a Protestant, you know, within the traditional religions of Christianity, Roman Catholicism, and all the orthodoxies. That's a church with priests, tradition, and everything is run in accordance with that. And the laity does, that falls in line, right? Their role is to fall in line, work particular ministries of the church, contribute through the church anything they do, where Protestants are maverick. I know about maverick, right? You take it on yourself to make a church, to, you know, of your own. And it's not the rightest thing you can do. It's a matter of being out there. It's disunity, you know. But it does not mean that it is without value. In fact, the gospel, Jesus Christ says so. He says so in so many words. Where there are people out there performing miracles in the name of Jesus Christ that are not part of quote-unquote us, meaning the apostles, right? They ask Jesus what they should do about that. Should we stop them? And Jesus says no. Something to the tunes of he who is not against us is with us. And in my view, that's what everything that is hetero-orthodox or unorthodox in Christianity equates to for me, right? Every Christian who has faith in Jesus Christ is my brother. Therefore, it's not a matter of you have to be orthodox to roll with me, right? So anyway, let's get back on track here. But it's an important distinction. You know, what happens in Protestantism with this idea of, in some cases, right, is that they have a head of theology that believes that works are like almost evil. There's, you know, it becomes like this Gnostic idea, where Paul says that you know, only the faith will justify you and works will not. That makes works like some evil, wicked thing, where that's not the case, because elsewhere we find out that faith and works operate hand in hand. One begets the other. If you're a person of faith, you will do the works. If you're doing the works, your faith will be alive and therefore guaranteed. Inasmuch as you're doing the works, you have a living faith, and that living faith is your guarantee to eternity, justified by Christ. It's a big deal. It's as big as it gets. It's at the core of what the Christian faith is all about, right? But it's that great, grand idea is within the context of St. Paul's argument with, or debate, it's probably a better word, St. Paul's debate with St. Peter over the imposition of Jewish culture, way Jewish civil law onto Gentile peoples. And the result of that, Apostle Paul wins the debate. And what happens going forward is Christianity is not established as a nation with its own civic code. It goes worldwide, and it is a kingdom that operates like threadwork, intermingling with this tapestry of sin, and best expressed in the Gospels as the tares growing with the wheat and vice versa, right? Having to separate. No, we grow all together. The kingdom of God is entwined with the kingdom of Satan, and that's what our new humanity is as Christians. We're in the world and in the kingdom. One foot in the world, one foot in the kingdom, simultaneously. And it's a bitch. It's a bitch. That's a head full right there. Right? That's a head full. But that's some good core Christian theological stuff to contemplate this week. Amen. Amen.
The New Abnormal. Subject matter related to the culture war.
Over the past couple of weekends, my wife and I have managed to get up and get out and attend entertainment events, right? One of them being the rodeo, right? The Mesquite Championship Rodeo in Mesquite, Texas. And the other one being a truck and tractor pull. This being the White Right truck and tractor pull, and that is in White Right, Texas, up in Grayson County, Texas, up by the Red River up there, Del Norte, right? And the events that we attended, this rodeo and this tractor pull, were similar in the expression of traditional American patriotism. And in both instances, I found myself feeling more deeply patriotic than I believe I ever have before. Now let me backtrack, give you a little bit of autobiographical material, right? This is me with regards to patriotism in the course of my life. When I was a young'un in elementary school, I lived in New Jersey, and New Jersey is kind of like the heart of Revolutionary War country, right? So much history happened in and around New Jersey involving the Revolutionary War. Where I grew up, you had encampments, we had one right in our fucking neighborhood, right? George Washington camped out in the woods where I used to go back and smoke pot, you know, in my neighborhood. My brother and his friends, they built a BMX track right there. There was no actual monument for it. There was just a sign to say, hey, here's a patch of woods and George Washington and the boys camped out here for a bit, right? But in the same town, on the other side of town, up the top of the hill, we had mountains, right? The first ridge of the Watchung Mountains of the Appalachian chain, right? Had a couple of sites where, again, Washington camped out. And then, but also these were high on a hill, so you had a expansive view of the coastal plains beneath. And yeah, we had one in our town there, and then another town where I grew up had one also. And both of those were called Washington Rock, go figure, but they were on the same ridge, but a couple of miles down from one another, with different perspectives. The range started to bend a little bit at that point, so the one in Greenbrook was northernmost of the two, and its viewpoint included Manhattan, right, up to New York City, and out to the Raritan Bay, over New Brunswick, and out into Middlesex County. And the other one in Bridgewater, New Jersey, the Martinsville Village, looked a little bit more southerly, east, but then more to the south than the one in Greenbrook. But anyway, all this to say, the Revolutionary War left footprints all around New Jersey. And as a kid growing up, I was well aware of it. George Washington slept in this house, and he slept in that house. I had a friend of mine, again, when I was a little kid living in Greenbrook, a friend of mine lived in a house where the original property had a house once upon, a couple hundred years ago, where George Washington supposedly slept. And there's all kinds of places dotted around the map in New Jersey. George Washington slept here. He had headquarters in all these different places. I remember up in Morristown, New Jersey, they had a big site for Washington's headquarters. And somewhere up around there in Morris County, they had another place, I think Jockey Hollow State Park, I think had something to do with Washington camping out there. I'm not positive about that. But all around northern New Jersey, and on down like the Trenton, obviously, where George Washington's crossing of the Delaware, the Battle of Trenton, and all that stuff, right? All New Jersey, New Jersey, New Jersey. So I grew up in a place that had this kind of history and those kind of landmarks all around it. And then while a kid in elementary school at the same time, we start learning the initial basic lessons of U.S. history, right? And it's almost from a comic book level when you're in third grade, you know, what you're learning right there. But I took right to it, you know. I was an American child, and we did the Pledge of Allegiance in the school, allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. And you got this history about what George Washington did, how he led the troops, and we overcame the evil Great Britain and the tyranny and all that stuff, right? You had, at an early age, through the public educational system, the first building blocks of patriotism established, right? And I don't know how differently things are now. I can't speak to that at all. But that's how it was back then. So I was awash with American patriotism. At the same time, you know, in the third grade, I believe, it was 1976. That was the 1776 to 1976, the bicentennial year, which is, in my lifetime, it was the most patriotic year of them all. Right? Now, there was a flash of patriotism that resulted from the events of the 9/11 incident in 2001. There was some kind of a repatriotism of the country, if you will, that occurred with that. But that aside, I recall 1976 as being a very patriotic time. Parades and all that shit. Maybe it was just, you know, me as a little kid, where I was at my age in life, what I was exposed to, what I was seeing, right? Now, you could have been a 30-year-old lesbian in 1976 and see the world as a really dark place and the United States as a horrible place, right? It's a matter of perspective, right? But in my perspective, at that time, everything was just very patriotic to a third grade boy in New Jersey in 1976. Right? Now, I lost that sense of patriotism as I got older. As we age in this world, we accrue adversity and we accrue disillusionment. And it's part of the maturing process. We start to realize that there's more to the picture than meets the eye, really, of anything that we are offered in education, you know, in elementary school. That is very basic level stuff that, as we learn further, there's a lot more details that challenge our original thinking, right? So my patriotism was challenged by the more that I learned about this country and the things that happened. I remember being extremely pissed off about the plight of the Native Americans, for example, right? The Manifest Destiny and everything that happened with that. I remember being pissed about that and hating the country over that, right? The racial stuff that happened in the South with the Jim Crow laws and before that, you know, obviously the slavery. I hated that shit, and I hated that about this country. And, you know, as a junior high school student, I was exposed to that detail of our history, which compromised the limited detail I was given as an elementary school student. And my patriotism waned, and it really actually just flew right out the fucking window, right? I didn't see anything to be proud of. And then I started looking squarely at the present. And I was starting to have an idea of like how corrupt senators were. And then there's my father at the dinner table telling me adult versions of this nation, right? The news that's happening. I was starting to be of age to understand it and have some semblance of curiosity about it all. And I went from elementary school patriot to junior high rebel. I hated the United States. I wanted it completely deconstructed, right? And rebuilt on a better foundation, devoid of the horrible history of the treatment of people along the way. And of course, that's a very leftist notion, right? It's a very leftist notion. I think at the heart of this nation's leftist ideology is that exact premise. But again, to me, in my experience, that is a junior high education. It is not the be-all, end-all. I come to the place where I came to then, only to come to further. And you know what? At the age of 56 years old, I have kind of come full circle, obviously, and returned to a sense of patriotism. And my patriotism is not based on a nation that treated the indigenous population in the manner that it did, you know, as a collective whole. And it is not based on a nation that that had slavery, right? And then that treated people who were racially Afro in a demeaning, lesser manner for the times even following slavery. No, that is not my vision of American greatness. What my vision of America greatness is the country that had a foundation, that had principles, a constitution in place that enabled society to overcome those sorts of ideologies. Maturity showed me that the people that populated, right, the colonists, which again is another fucked up thing, colonization in general, right? But that was done by what? England. England set out to rule the world. And I believe the power behind England is still doing the same shit, right? I don't think that's ever stopped. I think that is a part of their identity, And I think there was bleed over in the first 100 years of the culture in America, because the people that settled here were predominantly of British origin. But those people, at least the leadership of those people in the colonies that they inherited, right? They were generations already into this colonization, managed to come together and come up with a basis for governing a nation that allowed for the growth, that allowed for something that never had existed before, which was a nation of multiculturalism. It wasn't very multicultural at the time, but the Constitution allowed for it. And when the culture wasn't readily adapting the multicultural aspect, the Constitution stood as a framework to slap that limited means of thinking and behavior upside the fucking head and reset culture. Reveal, expose, shine a light on the parameters that the Constitution itself established and force culture to operate within those parameters. Now, an example of the success of that is something you may have heard me say before. Personal observation, once again. But once upon a time, right, like I said, I was born and raised up in Jersey in that Revolutionary War stuff and all that, right? But New Jersey, as it was, being raised there made me a quote-unquote Yankee, right? Right, a northerner, right? A northeasterner, a Yankee. And fate had it where I would move into the South and live out my life in the South. I endured culture shock being a Yankee moving into Georgia because a job took me there, right? And it was difficult for me. I showed up with all kinds of preconceptions, which was what the difficulty was really made out of. I expected to see when I got there worse racism than I saw in New Jersey. And the truth of the matter is that the South in Georgia and in around Atlanta, particularly, specifically, had evolved culturally way beyond what I knew growing up in the Northeast. In other words, New Jersey was way more fucking racist than Georgia. Because Georgia got bitch slapped with the civil rights movement, right? They were part of the South, and the Jim Crow laws and the civil rights, what are they called? The Civil Rights Act, right? Civil Rights Act of 1964 slapped them in the face good and hard and shone the light on the actual parameters of the Constitution of the nation and forced people in the southern states and everybody else who had that kind of mentality that demeans what we call the quote-unquote black people, right? African Americans, the way that they had been with the lynchings and everything like that. I am not here to say that that stuff didn't happen, that they had a reason to do. No, that's all fucking wrong. That was a cultural cancer. But by the Constitution and the process of government, that was addressed and corrected. Okay? So we have, as at our foundation, a document and a process of governing with checks and balances that, although culturally at times we are people and do fucked up things like people do, it is correctable. And there had been a lot of indications of corrected culture leading up to about 10 years ago or so. Well, 15 years ago. Times were changing. I think about things that were culturally quote unquote black, right? Urban. And I don't like racial orientation, right? It's how we have described culture in this country to a point. To me, the better word is urban. And in the urban culture, you just happen to have people who are racially black, right? In my better thinking and deeper in my heart, that's how I actualize the situation. But just to communicate on conventional terms, right? Black culture produced what? In the 80s, rap music. Into the 90s, hip-hop music, right? So those are things that we would identify primarily with quote-unquote black culture. And we have seen those elements of culture actually become mainstream standards. I mean, the same thing can be said for rock and roll. The origins of rock and roll music goes back to the blues, the field calls of the blues. Add a little bit of rhythm to it, right? Then you had the rhythm and the blues, and the rhythm and the blues became the rock and roll. And that is all culturally black, black culture, American culture, black people, however you want to designate that, which became mainstream music for everybody, right? So too did the rap, so too did the hip-hop. Everything is mainstream. So you see in the 90s, this crossover. In the 80s, they started doing it with intent. Think about Michael Jackson's Beat It song, right? He had the video. Eddie Van Halen played the lead guitar. Paul McCartney, I'm not a Beatles fan at all. Was it Paul McCartney and Stevie Wonder did the Ebony and Ivory song? You had Aerosmith, who I've talked about at some length a while ago. They did... They worked with Run DMC to do a rap version of the Aerosmith song Walk This Way. Right, this is in the 80s. A lot of this stuff was happening. There was these this cultural crossover occurring, right? And by the 90s, it had taken. And into the early 2000s, especially following 9/11, with the what I call that repatriotism of the country, right? What happened at 9/11 and the way people responded at heart to it did not know color. And then you would see in advertising, you would see in the stories that the books were made out of, the stories that the movies were made out of, there was an integration, and it had gotten to a point where it wasn't so contrived, right? Like, in the 80s, it seemed like a little bit forced. It's like some people, like, one guy looked at the other guy, and they nodded their head and say, yeah, it's kind of fucked up. Why don't we do a song and just try to lead the way out of this fucking mess, this racism mess, right? So there's something contrived to it. But then a generation goes by, and then it was a lot more natural, right? It was a lot more natural. The young people, like I was a burnout, right? I was a high school burnout. And then the high school burnouts, you know, kids that I was raising as teenagers or familiar with or anything like that, you know, in the 2000s, the integration of varied cultures, and without regard for race, just whatever, you know, was as normal as it was for me when I was like under 8, before I was being taught racism. Because we're taught racism. Right, the fact of the matter is, as kids don't really see the color. I mean, he's brown and he's not, and so, right? It didn't mean anything. It was just a a matter of point, you know? If you had to describe a person, well, he's got brown skin. That's one thing, right? Oh, he's got white skin. He's got blonde hair. Just a matter of point. Without consequence. And that's the way children operate. You know it, and I know it too. And because as children we understand that, that's where we get disillusional to find out that adults think and operate in a different manner. That disillusionment is a heartbreak that'll shatter a person's sense of patriotism about this country. But then we grow, right? Like I was saying before, I've evolved through time to circle all the way back around and become patriotic once again. Why? Because we have a foundation in this country that resolves that ugliness. Now the problem is that we have politics in this country that function on that ugliness. They require that ugliness. They demand that ugliness. We have politics in this country that prey on confused or ignorant people's wrongful sense of marginalization. What I mean to say is we have people that marginalize themselves. I done it to me when I was a kid, right? I marginalized myself. I made myself an outsider. I talked about forfeiting my patriotism, rebelling against that notion, disliking my country, wanting to destroy it and rebuild it in a different manner, right? To wash its ugly history away from me. I talked about being that kind of person, and this is true. I was all that. I marginalized myself. I made myself to be an outlier. I came to those conclusions based on my own disillusionment, and I decided to go my own way with it. And these were my days as a leftist. I was juvenile. I was on drugs. And my education, though I went to high school and graduated high school, was really just a junior high school education, because in high school I was too stoned to learn anything. I was there to cop drugs and meet girls. And I managed to finagle my way through and get a diploma. But I didn't learn hardly much of anything at all in those years. I would do all my learning in my 20s after I sobered up. And that was the beginning of the process. You see, as soon as I took them drugs out of my system, as soon as I recognized my own personal weakness, doors started to open for me, doors of understanding and seeing the world in a different manner and appreciating it for what it is. And then really taking the time to look at what it is. And I started to go from left to right, from progressive to conservative. You know, it took a little growing up, a little responsibility, a lot of sobriety, right? A lot of answering to my conscience to finally make of my existence in this nation what it really is. And I'm a citizen of a place that has a framework that manages culture through its trials as it consistently expands and takes in more and more from the rest of the world. It is multicultural. Perhaps its design in the beginning wasn't necessarily to be multicultural, but its parameters manage multiculturalism. Now, I was talking about the marginalized people, self-marginalized people in this country, right? When I feel left out, when I feel like an outlier, an outlaw, who represents me? Well, of course, there's a political party that is looking for outliers. They look to find people that are anti-American, that don't fit in. And they seek to represent that. And they acquire their power and wealth off of our own personal misunderstanding, misgivings, ignorance. See, the fact of the matter is, this is a country that really does not marginalize people. Not much. There are some instances, and it's worth talking about, probably at a different time, right? But in most cases, and you could probably bring it down ultimately in all cases, we marginalize ourselves, right? Nobody did it to us. We made choices. We labeled ourselves. I labeled myself as a rebel, as un-American. I labeled myself as a partier, a rocker. I made myself to be marginalized. That was my choice. And the minute that I decided I didn't want to be any of those things, poof, I was automatically within margin again. And there was no celebration. There was nobody to come and interview me or take an application. It just was, you see. It was all in my fucking head. It was all things that I had to untangle. It was all clouds that I had to clear and come to some kind of fucking realistic truth. And that's the problem about youth and drugs. When you put them together, you're living in delusion. And unfortunately, the people who are young and on drugs with this delusion are seeking representation for their scatterbrained notions of what this nation is and why the history was the way it was, right? The history, though they are negatives and ugly, they are steps on the way that made us, A, the first multicultural nation, and B, for a minute there, the first nation to actually manage multiculturalism. Now it's come undone because, again, the people that require cultural agitation, the people that require people to have a sense of being marginalized, left out of quote-unquote America, the Democrats. I'm just going to make it plain. This is what they feed on. This is what they prey on. They look for groups of people that are, well, they're disparate groups of people that have some kind of sense of being marginalized, and or they try to create groups that are marginalized. They harp on things like race, for example. They heat up, they fuel up racial differences. They invent things that do not exist. They create these problems because if you erase those problems, they will have nobody to represent. And when they have nobody to represent, they lose power, they lose wealth, they lose purpose, and they are fucking gone. And that's what needs to happen in this country. As a conservative person, as an old person, not quite senior, but getting there, right? My experience dictates to me that the best thing for me to have as a conservative is a Mexican neighbor who is a conservative and a black neighbor who is a conservative and whatever kind of division of person or of people that progressive people can make them be conservative. This is not an exclusive club as Democrats would make it out to be. It is absolutely not. I want to live in a world where I can function with the eyes of a child again, where cultural differences are concerned. And I don't even want to have a racial orientation. I think that is fucking stupid. What does that even mean? That guy's white, therefore fill in the blank. What's the blank? Therefore what? He's smarter, he's stupid, he's got a little dick, a big dick. What does it mean to be white? Oh, he's the big boss man? No, I'm a fucking custodian. I'm not the boss of shit. I clean up after brown people, black people, yellow people, red people, and white people. All fucking people of all colors. I clean up after them. To regard white as the big boss man is bullshit. I'm living fucking proof of that. And I've got stories, right? Now, I've gone off on a tangent. I think what I want to do here is I want to pause a minute. I was talking about patriotism and my newfound depth of emotion where my patriotism is concerned. That struck me lately in the past 2 weekends. And then I want to move on to something that has occurred in the news on this very day. The Supreme Court has ruled against North Carolina and Harvard University's use of affirmative action in their academic application processes, right? But what it's saying is affirmative action across the board as a policy is unconstitutional. It is against the Civil Rights Act in plain terminology. It violates the civil rights of citizens of the United States. Right? I'll talk about that. What I'm saying here kind of ties into it all, but let me finish what I started with the patriotism, and then I will move into that. I don't like to talk about matters of race because, again, I think it's the lowest form of thought in our humanity. I think it is a jailhouse, right? It's jailhouse ideology. That's kind of where it stems from and how it breeds. Because in the prison system, groups are separated based on the most obvious trait, right? Their color of their skin. And then they're set to war with one another. And that's how the populations are managed. It's stupidity, right? And then we come out of jail with this attitude against Chicanos and this attitude against the blacks and the attitude against whoever we see in jail, right? Who's not of our same skin. I say this, I'm the audio podcast. I am white of skin tone, you know. Farmer's tan, right? Right, kind of brown, but what you would call white generally. Back to my patriotism and the newfound depth of it. What had occurred at the rodeo first, and then secondly, in follow-up, just to validate the fact of the matter, at the tractor pull, they played the Star Spangled Banner, like is customary at large gatherings in the United States of America, right? Now, I haven't gone to any sporting events or anything like that. I don't know if they're still doing that shit there. I know that they made up the quote-unquote black national anthem and it was being played at, I don't know, football games, basketball games, baseball games. That extent of ridiculousness is beyond my mental capacities to even understand the stupidity involved with that and the ignorance. Sorry. I don't even get into that. I mean, but that's an expression of that junior high leftist racist ideology, right? That we have to contend with now. But before I get into that, I don't even want to get into that. I want to stick with the affirmative action, what that was, why that was a fucking problem, and hopefully what comes about it. But I was in attendance in groups over 1,000 people twice in the past 2 weeks where a Star Spangled Banner was played. And I recognized something in the lyrics of the word. And for once in my life, maybe for the first time, I actually got the sentiment of the guy, Francis Scott Key, who wrote it right now. I know just a vague amount of the history of the song. And I know that the Star Spangled Banner is more of a book than a musical sheet of lyrics. It goes on and on and on, right? But what we know as the Star Spangled Banner as a song is a short little snippet of it, right? What it's expressing historically is a moment out in the Chesapeake Bay where this Francis Scott Key is observing a battle in the War of 1812, where the British are shelling the living fuck out of a fort named Fort McHenry, somewhere around Baltimore. And it just seems horrible. There's no fighting back, just taking a pounding and taking a pounding, and all night long and all night long and all night long. And it seems like the fort is lost, that all is lost. But every time bombs explode in the air over the fort, you could still see that flag flying. So no matter what the enemy was throwing at it, that flag was still flying. A wall will blow up. Bricks will go flying all over the place, right? Men will get blown off the fucking wall and killed. But in all the destruction, all the abuse, that flag is still flying. A bomb goes off and there's a flash of light and you can see that flag is still there. And all this guy can do all night long is watch to see if the flag is still up on top of that pole. Because, of course, the way it is, you know, when you take over a fort, you take the flag down and put a new flag up, right? So the indication that this guy can get from afar through a telescope, you know, the state of that fort will be expressed in what flag is flying over it. All night long, that flag is still up there. The morning comes, the sun comes up, the flag is still there. And here's my emotion. It hit me at the rodeo. Why am I almost like coming to tears over this fucking song all of a sudden? I've heard it 18,000 times in my life. I've never given it a regard. I don't know how many times when everybody stood up and put their hand on the heart, I just sat there drinking beer and didn't give a fuck, right? All of a sudden now, out of the blue, a tear in my eye. Now as I tell the story, the tear in my eye happened the second week, the second Saturday at the second event at the tractor pull. Now as I tell the story, tear comes into my eye also. Because what's happening is I'm not just looking at 1812 anymore. I'm looking at 2023. And I'm seeing that what this nation is, at its core, at its root, at its most innocent, in the purest of its heart, with the better natures of its angels, is under attack continually by this mob of leftist politicians that prey on the weak, uninformed, and ignorant, to create division and store up for themselves power and wealth out of it. When all of those people, these quote-unquote marginalized people, who I like to regard as self-marginalized in their own ignorance, can by their own decision enter into America proper. But until they do, they empower the enemy of the nation, who is the enemy within. I don't even regard the leftist people with their fucked up beliefs, with their ignorance, as the enemy. They just don't know better yet. They will. When they have calamity come into their life and they need God, their eyes will change. When they get a girl pregnant and they see that baby, their eyes will change. When they grow older and they move away from narcotics and all the delusionment that comes with it, their eyes will change. People come to America to be American. The whole world wants to be here. And it's always been that way. Because there's something here. And what that something is being attacked continually. Why? Because there are counter powers in this nation that feed off of the idea of a rebellion against the nation. And that's what we get with the left. It's an actual rebellion against America. It is an un-American party of politics. any one of you involved with that can just simply walk away from it and enter in and be an American by your choice. Nobody's going to kick you out. Everybody wants you. I want you. We want you. And there's no terms. Just be American. Now you got to figure out what that means for yourself. But the only person that has marginalized you is you. People will speak untruths to you that if you believe them, you will divide yourself away from everything that is good about this place. So what I heard in the Star Spangled Banner over the last 2 weeks, it was what I see on social media with all these scumbags attacking this nation to destroy it. And remember, I was one. I know what I'm fucking talking about. The people want to destroy this nation. They're throwing everything at it to kill it. And I go to a rodeo and the flag is still flying. And I go to a tractor pull and the flag is still flying. You know what? The country yet exists in spite of everything. And knowing that, I have a little more optimism for the future. And that is something that we all need.
Thank you for tuning into Post Arlen Monologics. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postarlen.com.